On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Ooh, what a show I have for you today.
Whatever.
Hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show. Welcome to the program. I'm Ron Van Dam. How are you? Good to hear it. All right. That's good. All right. Good to hear it. Simple question. Let's not get crazy about it. I don't need your life story. Fine. Good. Well, how are you is a question that we ask each other all the time. When you meet somebody on the street, a neighbor or something like that, or someone walking their dog, the first thing you say is, hey, how are you? How are you? It's a rhetorical question. We don't care. We don't care. Don't respond to the question because no one cares how you really are. Don't you understand? It's just an expression. It's something we ask people to start a conversation. We don't care how you are. And if there's something wrong with you, tell it to somebody who cares. That sounds very cold, doesn't it? But it's so true, isn't it? How are you? Oh, well, you know, I woke up this morning and I've got a back. And no, I don't care. I know it's a rhetorical question, Ron. Don't answer it. Just say, fine, how are you? And let's get on with it. Continue to walk your dog, pick up the poop, and move on with your life. It wasn't a question out of interest. It's a phrase that we say to each other to be friendly. We make believe we care. It's a very interesting sociological question that we ask each other all the time. Hey, how you doing? You're not supposed to say how you're doing. You're supposed to say good, good, good. Most people respond because they want to get a little cute about it. And this is a response. And when someone says it, I inside and internally go nuts. You say to somebody, hey, how you doing? Well, if I were to complain, nobody would listen. Is how they respond to it. And you say to yourself, yeah, you're right. At least you get that. It's just an odd thing. Or you say to yourself, well, I've never heard anybody answer the question like that before 10 million times. Because it's not a question that needs to be answered. You nod your head and you say, okay, what's your point? But I have a doctor, just like you have a doctor. I go to the doctor for two reasons. One is for an annual checkup, and everybody should have one. I don't care what age you are. You should always go to the doctor once a year so that they can stick their finger up your ass and tell you to open your mouth and breathe deeply. I mean, that's the thing. And you get a little blood test to make sure that you're sugar levels are good and your cholesterol levels are good, and you get your little blood pressure reading to make sure you're not flying off the map with some type of pulmonary disease or something like that. Once a year, everybody, I don't care if you're 20, 25, 60, 15 years old, doesn't matter. And if you're a female, have somebody check your breasts. I'll do it. I won't even charge you. I don't know what I'm looking for, but I guess searching is half the fun. I don't know. Go to the doctor. When you reach a certain age, you get things called follow-ups for no reason whatsoever. You do that every half year. And a follow-up can be two-sided. One is because you got a problem that really should be monitored every once in a while. Or the other reason could be the doctor's just running out of liquid cash and needs to put the kids through college. And, you know, we'll say you got a follow-up and come on in. I'll collect maybe $300-$400 from you. We'll call it a day and we'll both be happy, right? Here's the funny part. When I go to the doctor and I'm sitting in that little room waiting for the doctor to show up for what seems like 15 hours, as soon as the doctor walks in, the doctor says to me, "Hey, Ron, how you doing? How you feeling? And what are you supposed to say?" So I just say, "That's your job. You tell me how I'm feeling. Because that's what I'm paying you for. I think. I don't even know. By the way, if you have to ever sit in one of those little doctor office things, you know, in the room itself, not the waiting room, but, you know, you wait for like half an hour and then they say, Ron, and you get up and it fools me every time. It's like, oh boy, they called my name. I'm going to be seen by the doctor now. You're not going to be seen by the doctor now. They're going to put you in the room where you're going to be seen. You're going to sit there for another half hour by yourself. And the nurse or nurse practitioner, whatever they call themselves, will check your blood pressure and say, the doctor will be in very shortly. Shortly means 6 hours. If they say the doctor is running a little late today, that means you might as well bring your pajamas. You're going to be staying overnight. If they say you're next, the doctor will be in next, you've got maybe 45 minutes. So what do you do in that little room? I steal the little latex gloves. I've, in my lifetime, stolen probably about 20 pairs of latex gloves. I bring them home. It's a feeling of accomplishment, like, okay, I've got something up on the doctor now. I took their, like, some latex gloves. I've never used them for anything. I'm going to have to find some people that I can use the latex gloves on. I have no need for these latex gloves, but I have them. And maybe someday I'll invite someone over to my house and say, I'll be with you in just a minute, and just leave a box of latex gloves with them and see what they do. Because to me, that's how I get back at doctors. I steal their latex gloves. It makes me feel better about myself. I used to steal the tongue depressors, but they don't use those things anymore. I don't think a doctor in the past 10 years has asked me to put a tongue depressor on my tongue and said, say, ah. I don't think they do that anymore, because I don't know why, but just I don't even know what it did before. Anyway, today's a medical show. I am going to visit here on the program with you, and if you're interested in this, then hang on. If not, then don't. We're going to look at various medical conditions that a lot of people kind of have. Some people don't. Some people do. All different kinds of conditions, psoriasis and breasts, different sized breasts and, you know, different diseases that some people have and other people never get, and maybe some advances in some medical technology and stuff to watch out for, and, oh, did you know this could happen to you? Oh, great, another thing that can happen to me. And if you don't have it now, you may have it later. Oh, great. That's great to know. Be aware of this disease. So if it happens, you know what it is. Okay, fine. That's what we're doing today. Today's the medical interview show. We're going to talk to a lot of different types of doctors, a lot of different specialties in doctorship. I don't know what doctorship is. I think it's a big boat that leaves every once in a while with a lot of doctors on it. I don't know. So let's get started right now and speak to some doctors. And hopefully you'll get something out of this. Hopefully.
Hello, Ron.
How are you, Dr. Tilton?
I'm fine. And you?
I'm doing very, very well. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Good. We're talking about cerebral palsy, which is something that we're all fairly familiar with, but just to start, what exactly is this particular condition?
Well, cerebral palsy is really pretty much an umbrella term. Uh-huh. It could be any number of different pictures. I often tell parents that if I had to say that the next patient I was going to see had cerebral palsy and they were on the other side of the door, I wouldn't know if they just happen to run on their toes or they're what many people think about someone who's more impaired in, say, a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
So it can come for a lot of reasons, but the common denominator on it is that often they have increased tone. Their muscles are tight. I often say it's kind of like having a rubber band uh-huh. that's really tight, and they have to fight those bands.
So is it a neurological disease?
It is. It is. The central nervous system, so basically your brain, to an injury to a developing brain, really right. is cerebral palsy.
Right.
And so it's really nice and it's exciting as a physician to have really a new, safe, and effective method that's been FDA approved to try to tackle some of this.
Yeah, we've heard about telethons for many of these things that go on and on over the decades, but we don't hear much about living with it and actually getting improvement in lifestyle when you have this. We don't hear about that a lot.
Well, one of the things that was really exciting about the study I was involved with mm-hmm. is that not only did they just sort of measure that your muscle was looser, but they looked at how the patient functioned, and that's your point, really important. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, a child doesn't care particularly if their muscles are a little tight like a rubber band, but they do care if they can't run and jump
yeah.
and play.
Yeah.
And so the medication Dysport was proven that it's not only safe, but it's effective to make the muscles basically allow the patient to do better, more functional.
Right. And then is Dysport for a certain age group?
Well, it's approved currently in the lower extremities for 2 years and above.
Uh-huh.
And so that's really where the focus is and was the focus in the study, looking at that.
Okay. So it goes beyond children then?
Oh, it does. There's some other, just for the botulinum toxin group, there are adult indications as well, and your physicians can really help you with that.
Uh-huh.
Because when you go and you say, is this appropriate for me, if you're a child or right. even older group, then they can direct you appropriately.
Okay. And are there any things to watch out for as far as getting involved in this medical program, as far as any adverse reactions?
Well, this study really helped us with that, because that's what everyone, you know, is always concerned about.
Yeah.
Is it safe for me, my child, whomever? Mm-hmm. And the study showed with the dosing in the lower extremity that it was no different than the people who got placebo.
Oh.
And so it really, in over 200 kids, it really did say that, you know, it really was effective and it really looked to be quite safe. So studies like this are incredibly important, because that's an important question every parent needs to ask of anything.
Yeah, no question about that. You know, but sometimes it's like a Sophie's choice. Do I get into this medication program because it will solve this problem, but I'm taking small amounts of chances that this could occur as a result? Those are choices
right.
you have to make sometimes, but it seems like in this particular situation, that's not that kind of choice necessarily.
Well, you know, I think that when your provider talks to you, they're going to talk to you about all of the things that can be involved.
Well, of course, because you don't want to get
so
sued.
So as a parent, you know, you've got to ask, if
yeah.
you know, could I get a bruise from a stick, whatever, you
sure.
know. And so all those things are to be knowledgeable about,
yes.
because every medicine has its own set of side effects.
Yes.
I gave you Tylenol. You know,
I know. Well, that's right.
So,
you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Right. So walking in knowledgeable and turning to your physician is important.
Yeah.
Specifically for this medication, Dysport, like I mentioned, it's FDA approved, which means they also supported it with the studies they saw.
Right.
You can turn to the website, which is dysport.com or dysport.com. And that would be, everyone's so well-versed on the Internet, someone could look at that and say, maybe this applies, and then turn to their therapist or their professional
yeah.
and say, how does my care fit into this?
Okay. Are most physicians aware of Dysport, or is it that new?
Well, it's been around quite a while. The new thing about it is that it's FDA approved.
Okay.
So hopefully more and more people will be more aware of it. And sometimes we, even as a physician, we appreciate someone coming to us and making us aware of new modalities that
mm-hmm.
it could help our patient, because that's what we're all about, is trying to help the patient.
Okay. So if it wasn't FDA approved, then it wasn't available to the general populace, is what you're saying before, but now it is?
Well, the thing is that those medications are approved for other indications.
I see.
And so therefore they are available. But the thing that's very reassuring and helpful is this FDA approval.
Okay.
It also means it may be more accessible because it is FDA approved when you start dealing with all kinds of companies that are trying to pay for this.
Okay.
And so I think it's a major leap forward and very exciting as someone who takes care of these children that we have an FDA approved this sport for safe and effective treatment.
Excellent. Hey, well, it's good to hear something good for a change.
Absolutely. Well, this is good.
This is good. This was a good
this
thing that
good.
We talked about a good thing right here. Dr. Ann Tilton, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. Luis De Janeiro is joining us. He's a doctor, president, chief executive officer of LLS. We'll find out what that is in just a second. And Gail Robos joins us. She is also a doctor, and she is... Gail, tell me who you're with, because you're with so many different factions here.
I'm a professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medicine and the New York Presbyterian Hospital in Manhattan.
There you go. There you go. That's a lot of things. And Dr. De Janeiro, let's talk about LLS. What is LLS?
So LLS is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society.
Mm-hmm.
We're a not-for-profit that's focused on driving research to find cures for the blood cancers.
Okay.
Blood cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, multiple myeloma, and many other diseases. And Dr. Robos is an expert in treating patients with acute leukemias.
Perfect, perfect. Okay, now we're going to throw a few more letters at people, and that's ASCO. They have an annual meeting. Who are they?
The ASCO, or ASCO as we call it, is the stands for the American Society of Clinical Oncology.
Uh-huh.
And the annual meeting that's happening is a meeting where physicians and scientists who study cancer and who treat cancer patients come together to understand the latest data from the latest clinical trials of new and existing cancer treatments to better understand how to use them in the future.
Okay. Now, are there any expectations during this year's meeting?
I think there are many. Perhaps I'll ask Gail to comment on them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very excited about this meeting because it's going to hit a lot of buzzwords in cancer. So your listeners have probably been hearing about words like immunotherapy or harnessing your own immune system to fight back cancer. Big buzzword this year has also been targeted therapy, so trying to hit the cancer cells directly and minimize side effects to the rest of the body. What we're excited about in acute leukemia land is also combinations of different new therapies with different old therapies. So you'll see some novel drugs being combined with some older chemotherapies. You're going to see more about combinations. And what I've been thinking about is that we're moving a little bit away from the single magic bullet concept to bringing older things and newer things together and trying to have a cocktail rather than a magic bullet.
Okay. Let me ask you, does the treatment of blood cancers vary from hospital to hospital, state to state, location to location?
I think that is a great question. And so the macro view of that is that there are standard therapies that are available everywhere, and there are practice guidelines that do govern administration of standard therapies. However, I will tell you that in the academic centers that see lots of leukemia, for example, things are a bit different. And it is possible that outcomes are different. It's, you know, if you go to a cardiology center that does a million operations, it might be different than going someplace that does only a few. And for rare diseases, I think the major difference is in the availability of clinical trials, because smaller centers may only have access to standard therapies, whereas in larger centers and bigger cities, there is usually better access mm-hmm. to clinical trials. So mm-hmm. patients with rare diseases where standard therapy isn't doing such a great job for them mm-hmm. may actually do well to go to the website. For example, the LLS.org website leads patients to figure out where they can go for clinical trials that might actually offer them something different from what standard therapy would be.
When we hear about these introductions at these meetings and symposiums and in the media, they're usually years away from the general populace utilizing those methods. Is that true, or does it move faster than I thought or slower than I thought?
So, Ron, in this case, it's Dr. DiGennaro here.
Yes.
In this case, much of the data that gets presented at ASCO...
Yep.
Represents the final stages of the evaluation
okay.
of these drugs, and that means they're pretty close to being used broadly for patients. That's one of the things that's so exciting about this meeting.
Uh-huh.
We're not talking about basic research, you know, the earliest stages a decade away from patients. These are agents that can be used now.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I mean, if I had an extreme situation where I needed, where time was not necessarily on my side, and I heard about these advances, but I can't use them, that's almost more frustrating than not even know that there was an advance.
Ron, I totally see where you're coming from, and believe me, I deal with this every single day, because I can run from a laboratory meeting where we're talking about things that feel like they are, you know, bringing Star Trek right to us, and then I run up to the floor and I have patients who are sick right now, and Star Trek isn't close enough.
Exactly.
So I absolutely see what you're saying. And I do think that sometimes it's true that in the media things are portrayed as more imminent than what they actually are. So you're not wrong in that at all.
Mm-hmm.
That said, we're excited because in this particular meeting, that we do seem to have a few agents and a few combinations that are much closer to right now than our usual. And what we're seeing at the meeting is presentation of what's called phase 3 data, which actually are much closer to leading to FDA approvals and imminent use of the medications.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular is already available through compassionate access protocols, and patients can actually use our hospital, LLS, other major academic societies to try to figure out if they can get more immediate access to an agent. Sometimes it's better than what you're thinking, which is that it's all over the news, but nobody can get it.
Right. Well, you know, I don't really care for the internet very much because there's like too much information and that kind of stuff. And
so Ron, let me tell you that the website of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, LLS.org, has really we are a trusted and respected source of information, and I would encourage blood cancer patients in particular, if they're looking for information, to seek out our website. They can also connect with experts that we have available on the telephone and on the web. It's an excellent source of information and cuts through all of the all of the buzz and the noise that's in the internet.
Yeah, I was going to say that I don't like the internet because there's over information, but it is helpful in situations like this where you can go directly to a source. I remember when I was younger, when I was sick, I'd have to call my doctor and I'd be on the phone like waiting for half an hour, an hour, and I couldn't get information at all. And that doctor was disconnected from general information nationwide and from general information from research unless they received papers in the mail or notification. So in this sense, the internet actually does connect people, and that is, That's about the only thing I found about the internet that was really helpful was you can make the connections that you need to make immediately. So, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
One more time, that website, please.
The website for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is lls.org.
Uh-huh. Excellent. Thank you so much for the information. It's good to know that people are working in order to make us healthier and take care of some of these very serious problems. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ron. Good day.
Take care.
Have a good one.
Hi, Ron.
How are you doing today, Doctor?
I'm well. How about you?
I am doing very well. Dr. Felicia Kosman joins us. She's the osteoporosis specialist, medical director of the Clinical Research Center at Helen Hayes Hospital, senior clinical director of the National Osteoporosis Foundation, professor of medicine at Columbia University, and JMA study investigator. She also invented the internet and also, well, I guess you didn't invent the internet, but you seem to have done everything else. So
I want to know about Peace Prize, too, but don't, you know, that's not applicable to today.
I had thought you won a number of Peace Prizes, so okay, it's only one. Anyway, thanks for being with us. We're talking about osteoporosis, which everybody kind of knows what it is. It is something that becomes a possibility. The older you get, the bones don't exactly favor you sometimes. Is this typically an age type of situation, or can it happen at other times in life?
Well, you know, we need to make a distinction between the normal bone loss that everybody has.
Yeah.
You know, every postmenopausal woman loses bone at the time of menopause, and it continues throughout the rest of life. But osteoporosis is the more extreme of that. And when you have osteoporosis, the bones become weak, and they get weaker over time. It's a chronic and progressive disease. And the major importance of that is that it puts people at risk for having bone breaks or fractures.
Yeah.
And these are the things that have consequences. So we're talking about pain, deformity, disability, and sometimes even death.
Okay, so let's say I'm in the front of my house and I'm walking down the sidewalk or something and I fall down and I'm 25 years old. Chances are I will just bounce back up, get back on my feet and continue and be a little sore the next day, and that's the end of it. That exact same fall when I'm 75, 80 years old would have different consequences. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, and particularly if your bone mass is low or your bone strength is low. And so not everybody at 75 or 80 going to fracture in that event, but the people who have osteoporosis are at much higher risk.
Okay.
And also when they're 65 and 55, at much higher risk for breaking a bone in that simple fall. Exactly right.
Okay. So how would I know if this is an onset type of concern of mine?
Well, the best way is through bone density testing. And this is a painless and simple test. It takes literally 5 minutes, totally non-invasive, zero risk. And it tells you how strong the bones are and how likely you are to have one of these minimally traumatic bone breaks.
Yeah. Is this something that most health insurances would cover? Because this is not due to an incident, it's a prevention situation, and I know some insurance companies get really stupid about that part.
Yeah, almost all insurances and certainly Medicare will pay for a screening bone density test in people at risk, absolutely,
right.
and it's actually a very cheap test.
Okay. How would I know that if I'm even at risk to even have that done, though?
Well, if you're a postmenopausal woman or a middle-aged man, you should talk to your healthcare provider about whether you have some of the risk factors for osteoporosis. But once you get to 65 for a woman and 70 for a man, you should get the bone density test even in the absence of risk factors. Some of the risk factors, and I think one of the most important ones, is if you've had a prior fracture in adulthood. So if you've already had one of these things where you fell on the sidewalk and had a fracture, you've got to get the bone density test because you're a person that may be the target for treatment.
Doctor, that's everybody that I know, so I don't know.
Well, everybody should get it,
Okay, what can I do if I'm shown to have some level of osteoporosis or the onset thereof? All right, that's step one. Now, what can I do about that?
So, you know, there are a number of kind of universal measures that everybody should follow. Getting a good diet that has certainly a decent amount of calcium, checking vitamin D doses, getting good exercise, whatever can be done to help prevent falls if you're a person who has multiple falls, if you're a smoker, stop, if you drink excessively, reduce. So those are the universal measures. But people who have osteoporosis need medication. Currently, we have a number of really good medications on the market. But the study that, you know, we're trying to talk about today was a landmark trial in over 2,400 women who received the new medication abaloparatide or a placebo or another very strong active medication on the market today. And the results showed that abaloparatide could actually stimulate the growth of new bone tissue and really dramatically increase the bone mass, which is exactly what, you know, we're measuring to define osteoporosis. And as a result of improving this bone mass, it strengthened the skeleton so much that fractures started to be reduced. Almost within, you know, weeks or months of starting the treatment.
Wow. Why couldn't they have had this stuff when I was younger? Why did they wait till now?
Well, I suspect you're in a good age range for thinking about it, Ron.
Yeah, I still
yes. You're not going to take this when you're 20.
No, just saying.
You know,
would have been nice to know.
Well, medicine is progressing, obviously.
Yeah. So, are we better off as a society now with where we're at? I mean, have the incidence of osteoporosis gone down, gone up because of the population's gone up, baby boomers? I mean, where do we stand?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a problem because we are getting older, and yes, osteoporosis is more common in older women and men.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we spend a huge amount of money and a lot of resources treating people for fractures and the complications of those fractures. Right. And we need to really reinvigorate the interest from both the side of the patient as well as healthcare professionals. To think about osteoporosis and to realize that we have treatments that are very effective at reducing the complications of this disease.
Okay.
And abaloparatide really changes the bone mass structure more completely than most of the medicines on the market today, which are more maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, well, that's incredible that that's even possible. And if it can grow, if it can grow hair, even better.
But no hair growth.
Ah, oh, damn. Okay. Where do we get more information?
Go to the National Osteoporosis Foundation website. It's nos.org.
Well, that's easy enough. Dr. Felicia Cosman, thank you so much for your time. That's good information. I like to hear information about things that can actually solve problems as long as we address them. That's good. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me, Ron.
Take care.
Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Jody Deedle joins us now. We're going to be talking about the open enrollment for something that you should be enrolling for. Jody Deedle is the Chief Compliance Officer at WageWorks. What is open enrollment?
Open enrollment is that favorite time of the year most employees look forward to about as much as they do a root canal.
Yeah.
It's when you make your benefit changes for the following year.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, you know, you get the stack of materials or you get sent to some online resource and, you know, typically people kind of dread it or don't pay attention or wait till the last minute. But I think it's very important for people to take a look and really kind of dig deep and take the time to pay attention to it, because many people find that they might be making some mistakes in their current benefit choices, and by taking some time to pay attention to it, they could really add some savings to their pocket.
So an open enrollment is not just for enrolling for the first time, it's making changes to something else.
That's correct, and typically employers offer that open enrollment every year.
Wow. Is this something that one looks at themselves, or you go to your human resources and you discuss it?
Every employer typically has a different time frame. Mm-hmm. Larger employers, it might be earlier in the fall.
Yeah.
Some might be just around the corner. Smaller employers, it might be a little later in the fall.
Okay.
And this is, you can make changes typically to your medical, dental, vision benefits.
Right.
And it's also the important time for you to enroll in ancillary benefits such as health flexible spending accounts,
yep,
dependent daycare accounts, or other benefits.
Oh, okay, there's a lot of stuff going on. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I've got the same thing you have, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think I caught it from you, though.
No, probably not.
Probably not. All right, so why is it that enrollment takes place during a certain time frame? Why can't somebody just change at any given point in the year? Why is there a restriction on that?
For most employers, most employer plans offer some tax-advantaged plans, and there's certain IRS rules about
okay.
them.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, huh?
And it's important that the plan maintains those rules.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, the carrier sets up those rules. So sometimes health benefit carriers don't want you flopping in and out of different plans, at will,
okay.
Because that really upsets kind of their pricing of the
yeah.
product or service that they're offering.
Okay. Now, I understand what you're talking about, but I don't know what the hell to do about it. If there are changes that I would like to, I mean, you can always get something better, I guess, if you take a look and see, but I wouldn't know what to do. Tell me about WageWorks and how that assists.
Sure. Well, WageWorks is a third-party benefit administrator of consumer-directed benefit accounts. So
okay.
we help employers by trying to help them make these benefits easier to understand
mm-hmm.
by providing a lot of tools and services
okay.
and by working with employers so that they can communicate their benefit choices in a much more comprehensive manner.
All right.
So you're right. It is daunting. There's absolutely no doubt about it. There's some easy steps, though, that I think can bring it home kind of into
okay.
bite-sized chunks.
Okay.
First, I'd find your favorite barista or grab a latte and sit down because it is going to take some time to sort through.
Okay.
Second of all, find out if your employer provides some decisioning tools. So many employers now have online decisioning tools that can help you determine which benefit might be the best one for you
mm-hmm.
or compare benefit plans side by side based on your individual circumstances. And that's really critical. And then thirdly, don't forget to look at those tax-advantaged accounts. Everyone should start by looking at their current carriers, by seeing what kind of expenses they've had,
mm-hmm.
and seeing if they've maximized the ability to pay for those expenses
yeah.
On a tax-advantaged basis through their employer. Importantly, we find several employees leave money on the table just because they don't take the time to pay attention to,
okay.
That kind of daunting task.
All right. So I guess the message is to speak to your employer and see what their parameters are, what their timetables are, and when you can set up a time to sit down and discuss it with them.
That's for sure. And take advantage of the opportunities they have. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
You might get a free lunch out of the deal by going to a benefit presentation that your employer
okay.
offers.
Okay.
And there might be several opportunities for you to learn about changes
yeah.
and what benefits are available. And employers want their employees to understand their benefits. It's no fun offering a benefit if the employee doesn't appreciate it and take advantage of it. So
yeah.
really important time.
Yeah, I know. Interestingly enough, I know that companies struggle to impart this information upon their employees. It's kind of odd because it's like force-feeding somebody saying, this is good for you. Please,
yeah.
please understand this. Please look at this. This is good for you. And yet they don't seem to get it.
And that's absolutely right. And so we've been on kind of a mission to help employees understand
yeah.
that this is a really important time of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can do it for you. This is something that you have to look at for
mm-hmm.
your particular family's situation, both
mm-hmm.
from a health needs and what kind of coverage you need
mm-hmm.
to what kind of budget constraints you have in your family and how can you provide the best mix of coverage to meet your particular individual needs.
Yeah. Let me ask you a little subversive question before we part company here. Is it like the pharmaceutical industry where certain benefit companies will try to make certain companies be a little bit more attractive toward their package In other words, you know, when a pharmaceutical company goes into a doctor and they say, here's the medication, and if you use this medication, we'll give you 10% off on you know, whatever. Is there any of that going on, or is it all good above board stuff?
Well, certainly in the health carrier business and in pharmaceutical benefit managers, PBMs they're called, you know, there's a lot of negotiation that goes on with different drug companies, and carriers then set up what's called a formulary, and those are certain drugs that they've put onto their package by both their effectiveness and you know, honestly, cost savings that they can get, so that they're negotiating that. I think it's above board, and there's always, you know, everyone hopes that people are doing the right thing. But there certainly are formularies, and I don't think that there's anything subversive going on there.
Okay. So if someone says go with Blue Cross, if the company says we suggest you take Blue Cross Blue Shield because that's the best deal, it's not like they're getting a perk from Blue Cross Blue Shield. That's just an analysis.
That's correct.
Okay, cool. I have to ask that question because people are, you know, think twice about things these days.
Well, there's lots in the news about pharmaceuticals right now, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, where do we go as employees to get more information?
Well, I think certainly you start with your employer and your employer's benefit package, but consumers should always feel free to go to www.wageworks.com. There's lots of resources there to find out about these ancillary accounts and kind of what things to consider in making your benefit decision.
Okay, good. So we can go to you as a direct thing for some answers. That's a good thing. That makes me feel better now. You made me feel better.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Thanks, Jody. Good speaking to you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Ron Van Dam on Metro South Podcasting. Oy, he's such a mensch. I mean, a nice mensch, don't get me wrong, but still, really, a mensch.
Hello, Dr. Weston. How are you?
Good. How about you today?
I'm doing fine. Dr. Shannon Weston is here. We're talking about Ovarian Cancer Awareness Month, which happens to be September. It's always a month for something to be aware of. And well, it is. But nonetheless,
Very true.
Yeah. But we should be aware of it all the time, not just in September. Okay. Ovarian cancer, how prevalent is it? Are we making advances toward it?
Absolutely. You know, it is overall a rare disease when it's compared to most cancers, but it's the eighth most common cancer in women, and by far it's the most deadly of all the gynecologic cancers.
Okay. And
go ahead.
No, go. Well, I was going to ask you what we should know about ovarian cancer.
Absolutely. You know, I think for women in general, there is an idea that ovarian cancer is a silent killer, but actually that's not quite true. It's a little bit misnamed. The majority of women that have ovarian cancer do recall symptoms that they had. It's just that they're very subtle and nonspecific. And so things like abdominal pain or nausea, very easy for a busy woman to kind of put off and ignore and ascribe to other things. And so in general, if women are having symptoms that are persisting more than 2 weeks, they should seek the care of a doctor.
Okay.
Other things that I would say about ovarian cancer is once a patient is diagnosed with ovarian cancer, there are two extremely important things they can do. Number one is seek the care of a gynecologic oncologist like me. We are physicians and surgeons that specialize in the care of ovarian cancer. And then the second thing is to have what is called BRCA testing.
And what is that? What does that stand for?
So one of the major risk factors for ovarian cancer is the presence of a BRCA mutation. Now, what does that mean? You know, in a woman's cells, we carry all sorts of things. And carrying an abnormality called a BRCA mutation can put a woman at risk for the development of ovarian cancer, as well as breast cancer, okay. and maybe even some other cancers. And what we recommend now is that any woman with a diagnosis of ovarian cancer have that BRCA testing, because approximately 15 to 20% of women with ovarian cancer carry that gene.
Okay. So it is, it's predetermined. In other words, it's not something that just develops. This is through a genetic situation.
Exactly.
That okay? So you can be tested right. to see. Can you be tested to see if you are prevalent for that gene?
That's a great question. We don't generally recommend that any woman walking down the street have mm-hmm. a BRCA test. Mm-hmm. For women without a diagnosis of ovarian cancer, there are specific kind of harbingers or criterion to consider. Uh-huh. You know, if there are members of the family with either breast or ovarian cancer, if the woman herself has a history of breast cancer, uh-huh. Specifically at a young age, less than 50, or if there are multiple cancers within the same family, mm-hmm. those might be reasons to seek out a genetic counselor who can go through that family history very carefully and determine if BRCA testing is a good idea.
Okay. Is this a fast-moving disease, or is it like a prostate thing where it's fairly slow-moving?
Yeah. It's a fast-moving disease, and, you know, as far as how quickly things move, it's very hard for us to tell.
Right.
What usually happens is women are a little delayed in getting their care because, again, those nonspecific
yeah.
symptoms we were discussing.
Yeah.
And so when they come in, they're advanced stage already. And advanced stage ovarian cancer is quite hard to completely cure.
Uh-huh.
Now, we've made a lot of advances, and we can get the disease to go away
uh-huh.
with a combination of surgery and chemotherapy. The problem is, in the majority of women, it will return. And when it returns, we don't have great options, although there are some.
Oh, okay. All right. So the earlier caught, well, with any cancers, is the earlier caught the better, and then you're up against the
Absolutely.
Wall where, well, I can't catch it that early because I don't know what it is that early. So many things mask themselves as just common everyday little aches and pains, especially you go to the gym.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And, you know, we women and men, too, we're busy. We
yeah.
have a lot
yeah.
to do. We're taking care of family. We're taking care of friends. We're taking care of work. And
yeah.
it's easy to kind of blow off those little symptoms and say it's fine. It's no problem. And
yeah.
forget to take care of yourself.
Why do you not suggest some type of pretesting in order to avoid that entirely? Why is that frowned upon?
Yeah, it's just that it's not been helpful to identify the majority of patients that have it. So
okay.
we have to be somewhat selective in the types of patients we test. In addition, if we know a patient has cancer or we know that mm-hmm. there's a BRCA gene in the family,
yeah.
we can really focus in on that type of test.
Okay.
In a patient that just kind of, or a woman that comes in without a cancer diagnosis and we test, if the test is negative, it doesn't really tell us much. It's called an uninformative negative,
okay.
in that they could still potentially have something and we just don't know.
Okay.
So what we found is testing patients with the diagnosis can potentially impact, you know, them and their treatment and also impact the family.
All right. So where do we go for more information? Because there's a lot to talk about in a short amount of time.
Yeah, absolutely. You can go to myocjourney.com. Which is a great online resource for women with ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are, of course, many ovarian cancer or gynecologic cancer organizations,
right.
the Foundation for Women's Cancer, Ovarian Cancer Research Alliance. And so there's some awesome opportunities online.
Yeah. Before we part company here, because we have another minute, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Is there a certain age when women should be having continual gynecological exams? Is that something that is automatic, or you wait until a certain age, or you have to be prompted
Sure.
into doing it?
We recommend the beginning of gynecologic exams at about age 21.
Okay.
And some of that is related more to cervical cancer screening.
Uh-huh.
But those exams also involve a pelvic exam, which uh-huh. is when the physician examines the uterus and the ovaries. Uh-huh. And so we recommend those every year.
Okay, and I'm assuming that most young women, certainly until the age of 30, probably ignore that advice.
Well, it depends. I think we're getting out there, especially with things like the HPV vaccine
yeah.
and the importance of pap smear screening. I think we've made a lot of progress
right.
in getting women into the doctor's office. It's just a matter of keeping them there. And again, going back to that, I'm so busy and I need to do all of these other things.
Well, once they're in there, you have to lock the door. That's what you got to do.
That's right. I'll try that next time.
Yeah, give it a shot. Dr. Shannon Weston, thank you so much for your time this morning.
It was great to speak with you. Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, that was our doctor show for today. A rapid succession of doctors. Boom, 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 boom. Doctor, 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 doctor. Hope it was of some good to you. I won't bother you with doctors again for a little while now. So I wish you peace. I really do. I really do. Have yourselves a wonderful day.